It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up with the Memorial holiday days away, we'll talk to an epidemiologist about how people can stay safe and practice social distancing. First, it's Food Friday. The holiday weekend is usually a time to have people over and get together around the grill. While we may not have the gatherings we're used to, many of us will still be firing up the grill, maybe for the first time this year. Before tossing on our favorite meats and veggies, it's important to make sure our grill is in good working order, that we have the equipment we need, and if we need a replacement, where to start looking. Good news, our next guest is a barbecue and grilling expert, and he's here to help us sort it all out. Meathead Goldwyn is founder of AmazingRibs.com and the author of Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling, a New York Times bestseller, also named one of the 100 best cookbooks of all time by Southern Living Magazine. Meathead, welcome back.
Hey, it's good talking to you again.
Well, I'm assuming that Memorial Day weekend will not be your first time grilling this season, but for a lot of people, it is. What should we do to give our old grill a shakedown cruise and make sure it's ready to rock for the weekend?
Well, if you've got a gas grill, it always helps to look at what they call the venturi. It's where the gas and the air mix. Just behind the dials, there's an opening. Spiders sometimes get in there, and they can block the airflow and or the gas flow. So you want to look around there. You want to give it inspection. You want to make sure the hose doesn't have any cracks. Open up the valve on the propane tank. Take a good sniff. Make sure there's no gas smells. If you want to be really careful, mix a little dish soap with some water and paint it on the areas around the valves and see if it's bubbling. And really important, scrub down the cooking surface, the grill grates, to get those scrubbed down real clean. When you fire it up, you'll see a lot of smoke, but that's grease smoke. It's not tasty. Grease smoke doesn't taste good like wood smoke. So get all that grease off of there, and whatever you do, do not put those grill grates in the dishwasher unless you want to sleep on the couch for a week.
What is the best way to clean those grates? I usually just, you know, I mean, every time I use it, I scrape it down with a wire brush, a little oil, mm-hmm. but should I be doing more than that on the grates?
No, that's fine. You can use a paint scraper. A lot of people ball up a wad of aluminum, and actually aluminum foil actually works well. Wire brushes work great. They're the best all around for both sides. You got to get the underside, but you got to be careful. Some wire brushes are built cheaper than others, especially the wood handled ones, and bristles will sometimes come out. And if a bristle comes out and sticks to the cooking surface, it can get on a burger or on your chicken, and you do not want to eat a wire bristle brush and spend the holiday in the emergency room. So if
good,
you're going to use a bristle brush, make sure you check the surface carefully in daylight or with a really bright flashlight to make sure you didn't leave any bristles behind.
How do we know if it's time to put the old grill out to pasture, charcoal or gas, and go shopping for a new one?
Jesus, like, how do I know when it's time to buy a new computer, you know? you know, it depends on what you like to cook. If you're a steak lover, for example, you need really high heat to get a great dark sear on steaks. And for that, charcoal is better than gas. Most gas grills just don't have the power to sear a steak beautifully. They can make grill marks, and grill marks are brown hatch marks, branding on the surface. And those hatch marks are the result of what's called a Maillard reaction. It's a chemical reaction of the protein changed by heat from the hot metal. But what you really want is a totally brown surface, Maillard reaction from edge to edge. And most gas grills just don't have the juice to do that. Charcoal usually does. Now, some gas grills come with what they call a sear burner. And those sear burners have extra energy, and they can sometimes get you a great sear on a steak. But everybody wants to make a steak as good as they do at the steakhouses. And although most steakhouses cook with gas, your regular backyard gas grill generally doesn't have the power. So charcoal is the way to get that steakhouse flavor.
We're talking to Meathead Goldwyn on this edition of Food Friday, talking about grilling. He's got a lot of advice for gear and techniques. You can join in with your questions or your own advice at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. Meathead, you're a big advocate of measuring temperature, both inside the grill itself and, of course, using the meat thermometer to get the temperature, the internal temperature of the meat we're cooking. Can I use the same thermometer to do both, or do I have to have two different things here?
Well, first of all, let me praise you. You've done your homework. You obviously have poked around the website or my book. Thank you. Yeah, you're right. I'm a fanatic about temperature control. Cooking, or any kind of cooking, indoors and out, is all about temperature control. What is the temperature of the air? What is the temperature of the food? For example, a medium rare steak is the most juicy and the most tender, and that's 130 to 135 degrees. Poultry, in order to be safe, has to be 160 to 165 degrees when you take it off the grill. So to do that, you need a thermometer that can measure the temperature of the food. That's the most important, measuring the temperature of the food. If you've got a good digital thermometer, and you can get a great digital thermometer for under $30, or even some under $20, and we have a guy, an electrical engineer, who tests thermometers for us. We've got a buyer's guide. We don't sell anything, but we rate and review thermometers. You can go and find one on our site and then click on the link and go find it somewhere. But measuring the temperature of the inside of the meat means you'll never have to stand there at the head of the table, and when people cut into their steaks, expensive steaks, and say, oh, gosh, it kind of got away from me, I'm sorry, or worse still, take Granny to the hospital because the chicken's way underdone. If you want to spend another $40-$50 and get a really good digital oven thermometer, which is a grill is really just an outdoor oven, only it doesn't have a thermostat. These are probes that you clip on the cooking surface right next to the meat, so it feels the same temperature as the meat does. And that's really helpful, because can you imagine cooking indoors without knowing what your oven temperature is? You don't know that for sure outdoors. Most grills have a thermometer on them, but they're these cheap dial thermometers. They're the cheapest thing that they can get, and they're up in the dome of the grill, which is great if you're going to eat the dome, but the food is down below, and it's a different temperature down there. So if you can afford it, get two thermometers, one an instant read for the meat and another a probe for sitting next to the meat.
Now, one technique thing that I learned from you, actually, I think last time you were on, and it's been working great for me, and I want to bring it back up. Now, I usually thought you want the grill hot. You get the meat on the hot grill. You sear it on the outside and just keep on cooking it. Then, of course, the outside gets overcooked. You talk about, I think you use the phrase reverse searing, where you heat it up at a, you know, not as high temperature and then finish it with the sear. Can you talk about when we want to do that and what it does?
Yeah, oh, you're advanced.
Oh, not as advanced as I make myself sound, I promise you.
You graduated from the beginner's class. You're in the advanced class.
Exactly.
It's a really important concept. Meat is 70% water. Water doesn't transmit heat very well. So if you take a piece of meat and put it directly over the flame or glowing coals, you're going to cook the exterior very rapidly, but it will take a while for that heat to get all the way down to the center. And on a very thin piece of meat, like a skirt steak, you want to put it over direct heat so you can sear the exterior and get that dark brown Maillard reaction, which is full of flavor, but not overcook the interior. So to do that, you've got to have a lot of heat. But if you've got a thick piece of meat, like an inch and a half ribeye or a turkey breast or even a chicken breast, mm-hmm. It takes a while to heat those, and the very best way to do a chicken or a thick steak is you divide your grill in half, and if it's a charcoal grill, you push all the charcoal to one side, or a gas grill, you turn on the burners all on one side and leave the burners off on the other side, and you have two zones, a hot zone, which is directly above flame or glowing coals, and a non-hot zone, which we call the indirect or the convection air zone. and that's a lot cooler. And you put the food on the indirect side where it warms gently. And so there's time for the temperature to warm all the way through, and the food is evenly cooked from edge to edge. But you don't have a dark exterior. What you've done is you've cooked the interior. Now, just before it's done, let's say we're doing a steak. 130 to 135 is medium rare, perfect temperature. Or a chicken, 160 to 165 is safe. You're going to start it on the indirect side and bring it up to about 10 degrees below your target. So 120 on a steak, 150 on a chicken. Then you're going to move it over to the hot side, right above. That's infrared radiation. That's glowing infrared. It's radiant heat. It's much more powerful than warm air. You lift the lid, and you let it pound the underside with that infrared radiation, and you flip it. And you flip it. And that goes against everything you've been told, but everything you've been told is wrong. You flip it and flip it and flip it. That way, you're cooking the exterior now on the direct infrared radiant heat side, and you're browning the exterior, and you're not going to burn the chicken skin because you flip it. And you flip it. And when you flip it, the hot energy that is built up on the underside now is on the top, and because the lid is up, the energy bleeds off into the atmosphere rather than working its way down to the center. So you cook the inside in convection airflow on the indirect, and the outside on the hot side over infrared energy, and you'll get perfectly cooked food every time, not overcooked in the center, and you don't get that rainbow look on a steak where the exterior is dark brown, just below the surface it's tan, then in the center it's pink, and then finally it's rosy. You'll get it all the even color.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Meathead Goldwyn of AmazingRibs.com, author of Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about grilling gear or grilling techniques? What are your favorite things to put on the grill this time of year? Do you have a way to get them just right? Or are you still chasing perfection? Is there something you want to try cooking on the grill, maybe for the first time ever, and you need some starter advice? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking to barbecue whisperer Meathead Goldwyn, author of Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how to grill, what to grill with, or anything in between? What are your favorite things to get on the grill these first warm days of the year? Do you have a special recipe or tip to share, or do you need advice on how to cook whatever you want to cook on the grill? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Dan is with us in Oconomowoc. Dan, hi.
Hi. Hey, my charcoal grill is about ready to give up the ghost this year, I think. And I'm curious about the pellet grills. Do they get as hot as the charcoal, or?
What do you think, Meathead?
No, they don't. These pellet grills are really better called pellet smokers. They're like your indoor oven. There's a little cup in the bottom of the grill, or the smoker, I should say, that has these little wooden pellets in them, and they burn, but there's a metal plate above them, just like your indoor oven. And so you're never exposing the food to direct infrared radiation, so you can't really sear like you can on charcoal. The beauty of the pellet smokers, though, are they're absolutely brain-dead simple to operate. They're electronically controlled, so you got to have an outlet nearby, and you can set the temperature, and it goes to that temperature and stays there. Really very low variation from that temperature. So you can set it at 225, throw a beef brisket on there, walk away, and 12 hours later, because that's what it'll take, it's absolutely perfection. So what it does well is low and slow, or it can get warm in there, but it's warm air, and warm air doesn't give you that dark exterior that hot metal, like a frying pan, or infrared radiation. So if you're a steak lover or a lamb chop lover or a burger lover, you're going to be better off with a charcoal grill. But if you love ribs, pulled pork, brisket, smoked turkey, pellet smokers are fantastic. Now, there's one exception. The new Weber pellet smoker actually has exposure to direct flame, and it can sear, but it's got a couple of, it's the first one they've ever built, and it's got a couple of glitches in the initial model. I would wait until they come out with version two.
Dan, hope that helps. We'll go now to Jim in Milwaukee. Jim, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
Well, I've just got a sous vide cooker, and I'm going to try to do steaks this weekend. And I have seen people use it for steaks where you'll, you know, do a sous vide, you know, cook on it for till maybe it's 110, 120, and then do what you said, put it over direct, very hot heat on a charcoal grill to finish it to 130, 135, 140, wherever you want. Have you ever done anything like that?
Yeah, not only that, I wrote a book on it. I call this sous vide Q, sous vide and barbecue combined, and it's a Kindle book on Amazon for only $3.99, and it's a great technique. For listeners who don't know what sous vide is, you put the food in a plastic bag, and you seal it up where there's no air in there. You just slip it into some water, and you put a heater in the water, and the water warms to exactly the temperature you want it to. I recommend that you don't go as low as 110 or 120. That's a danger zone. Microbes can grow in there. You want to get it a minimum of 130. Now, I know that's right on the edge of medium rare, but don't worry. Sous vide will not ruin your steak. Take it up to 130. But when you take it out of the, and you can leave it in that temperature, you can never overcook it. It's set for 130. You can never get to 135 or 140. It'll never overcook. And you'll leave it there for 3-4 hours. And then you take it out, and the exterior is just butt ugly. It's gray. It's tan. You're going to take it and throw it over a direct hot flame. And you know what I love to do? You know what a charcoal chimney is? It's like a, it looks like a coffee can, and you put charcoal in it to start your charcoal fire for grill.
Sure.
Well, if you've got a charcoal chimney, and you can get one for like 20 or 30 bucks, when you pile that halfway full and you load it up with charcoal and light it, the top end of that chimney is well over 1,000 degrees. That is way up there in steakhouse steak range. You put a little cooking grate on top of that baby, and it's like cooking over the back end of an F-16. You take it out of your sous vide bag, you throw it on top of the charcoal chimney, flip, 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 flip. You got to move fast because it won't take long, 3 or 4 minutes per side maximum, and you've got a fantastic sear. It's a lot of fun. I've done this. I did 500 of them for a crowd at an event in Delaware last year. Go to Amazon and check out my Kindle book for $3.99, and it tells you all about sous vide Q.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Zach in Lake Mills. Zach, hi.
Hey there, guys. I just had a tip. I know this is about meat, but you got to have something to go with the meat. Beets. Do you like beets? A lot of people don't know that you can just take your beet, put it directly on a grill, 10, 20 minutes, depending how well you want it done, and the skin falls right off. You don't have to do anything with that strange beet skin.
I didn't know that. You have successfully identified the only food in the world that I won't eat. I have eaten some really weird stuff in foreign countries. I just have never. I think it stems from an unpleasant experience as a boy with borscht. But I just don't care for beets. But that's cool that this, because getting them skinned is hard. That skin is like leather.
Thanks a lot for that tip. Now, speaking of anything on the grill, our producer tells me, you know, you're a Chicago guy, but you know we like our cheese here in Wisconsin. And I understand you're working on grilling. You're grilling cheese?
Well, you can actually grill some cheeses right on the grill. There's a kind of cheese called halloumi. First of all, grilled cheese sandwiches are really good on the grill. You can't get too hot, But you make up your grilled cheese sandwich the way you normally would. Paint the outside with butter and put it over a medium to low flame, and you'll get some of that smokiness. In fact, you can throw some wood on there, and they're wondering, grilled cheese, grilled. What a thought. Here's a fun one. When you buy Parmigiano Reggiano, the real Parmesan from Italy, the wheel has a very thick exterior crust, and it's all natural cheese. There's no plastic on it, but it's like hard as a rock. And Italians know Nonna used to take that exterior and throw it in the soup, and it would kind of gelatinize there and adds flavor to the soup. Take that, and you can often buy it at a cheese store cheap, that Parmigiano Reggiano crust. You throw it on the grill, and it gets soft like taffy. It pulls like taffy, and you put that on a little bit of a crusty French bread. It's wonderful. It's a great deal of fun. Hard cheeses, dry hard cheeses, you can actually grill them, and with a little thing like fig jam on a grilled piece of cheese. Fantastic. Really fun.
All right, Meathead, we have just a minute left. Leave us with one tip or bit of encouragement. I'll let you take it wherever you want in that minute.
Well, we've already touched upon it, but I can't emphasize enough how important thermometers are. I know a lot of you out there, particularly the guys, I don't need a thermometer. But seriously, you really can't tell by poking the meat with your finger and comparing it to your hand. Your hand and my hand are different. The different cuts of meat are different firmnesses. Nothing will make you a better cook overnight than a good meat thermometer. I know it's probably too late for this weekend, but go to our website and look at the thermometer reviews. Order one from the manufacturer or from Amazon, or find it at your hardware store and get a good digital meat thermometer. Nothing will make you a better cook overnight.
I'm sold. Meathead, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob, good talking to you. Have a happy weekend, everybody.
You too. That's Meathead Goldwyn, founder of AmazingRibs.com and author of the book Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. He talked with us about what we need to know about getting our grills in working order for the holiday weekend. Coming up after the news, a public health expert joins the show to talk about how people can practice social distancing as they head out maybe for the holiday weekend and as stores and other places reopen around the state. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up for Muslims, Ramadan is a time to celebrate and strengthen community bonds. We'll learn how they kept that spirit alive during the coronavirus pandemic. First, the Memorial Day holiday weekend is typically a time that people travel to their cottages or cook out with friends or hit up some sales at the mall. But these aren't typical times. While state and local governments are easing some restrictions related to the coronavirus outbreak, the danger of the disease remains. Our next guest joins us to talk about how people can strike a balance between enjoying the holiday weekend and maintaining social distancing practices to keep themselves and others safe. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the program. It's a pleasure.
Well, we've had the overall safer at home order and in the state. Some counties and local governments keeping it up, but even they're winding it down. What are some things that you want people to have top of mind, big picture, as we start to go out and do the stuff that we haven't been doing over the last month and a half or so?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what everyone can keep in mind is that the number of cases that are occurring, you know, that really hasn't changed from a week ago or 2 weeks ago. And in fact, we're detecting more because our testing capacity is increasing. And so, we should keep in mind that had the safer at home order not been struck down, it would still be in place and we'd still be trying to reach those gating criteria to enter into, the next phase. We should be thinking about stepping out cautiously and slowly in that context?
We were doing the safer at home orders for a while, a lot of changes in our daily lives. From what we know, did it make a difference? Did it help slow the spread of the disease and save lives?
Absolutely. I mean, we can see within Wisconsin, you know, that we really did protect our healthcare capacity, which is one of the main goals, to not have all of a sudden a bunch of cases occurring at the same time where we wouldn't be able to adequately deal with treating patients in the hospital setting. And we were able to flatten the curve by engaging in those kind of protective measures.
Let's get into some scenarios that people might be thinking about. First of all, with the holiday weekend, we might want to get together, have a cookout or other family or friends gathering. What kind of things would you suggest to keep that, if we decide to do it, to keep it as safe as possible?
Yeah, like I said, I think entering back into social interactions in a sort of slow and cautious way, slowly expanding beyond your household to maybe, you know, one other household or small group of friends. And if you're going to get together, safer practices are to do so outside, to maintain 6-foot distance from each other, and even to wear cloth masks. These are all kind of the ways that we can safely get together and slowly get together as everybody around us in our community starts to interact more.
And people also thinking about visiting family members, maybe can the kids visit grandparents, that sort of thing. What should we keep in mind for that?
Yeah, as we move forward into reopening, populations that are older or have chronic health conditions are going to still be at higher risk of complications from COVID-19. So we should think about ways that we can smartly reunite with family that fall into those groups. And so, you know, one thing is, if your household has been fairly strictly social distancing, only going to the grocery store perhaps, and people are working from home, and you've been doing that for a couple weeks, you're in a much better position to maybe get together with grandparents than someone who, you know, has not been engaging in social distancing so strictly, you know. And when you do get together, maybe don't have it be the entire extended family, but a smaller group, and try to get together outside, kind of those same general practices. Maybe go to the park and have a picnic and sit on blankets 6 feet from each other where you can still talk, you know, but sort of try to continue to protect vulnerable populations of people that are in your life.
Amanda Simonek is with us, a professor of associate professor of epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee, talking about how to get back to normal activities in as safe a possible way. Now, you and a bunch of colleagues, Amanda, have a Facebook group called Dear Pandemic, where you answer questions from the public. What have people been the most curious about?
Yeah, so Malia Jones, Dr. Malia Jones at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Allison Buttenheim at University of Pennsylvania, they know each other. They started this group, and I have joined on, and there's 10 of us, all PhD-trained scientists, that basically we became the point of contact in our family and friend networks as sort of their resident expert, because many of us are epidemiologists or demographers or nurses. And they were asking us questions about, what do we do? What does this mean? What's the long-term outlook for the pandemic? So we decided to form, or Malia and Allison formed this group to field those questions on a wider spread scale, to open it up to other people. And we are getting asked questions, you know, is it safe to go visit with grandparents? Can I go out to a restaurant? Should my pool be open? Or if it's open this summer, should I go? So, you know, we're really entering what we would call a harm reduction phase of the pandemic response, where instead of everybody kind of being able to wrap their minds around staying at home as the thing that they can do to protect themselves, we suddenly have an array of choices. And so each one of us, myself included, has to now sort of assess on a spectrum of personal risk what interactions we will take and how to go about minimizing sort of our risk of exposure in the community. And so we are fielding all kinds of questions related to that right now.
What would you put at that higher risk end of things? Stuff that we want to go out and do, but maybe we're not quite there yet.
I think as a general rule, we can think about being in enclosed spaces where social distancing is not possible, where people are not wearing cloth masks at the higher risk category, right? And then on a spectrum, going to sticking with your household, only going outside, you know, or getting together with a small group of people on the other end of that spectrum. So we want to try to continue to minimize, you know, your exposure to a variety of people. The more consistently you can keep your social circle for now is probably safer. You know, so being sort of going to a setting where you don't have a lot of control over how many people are there and you're in an enclosed space, that's going to be the most risky.
One kind of mental hurdle sometimes, I think, is we think, oh, I'm going out, I'm young and healthy, I'm pretty safe here. How much of this are we doing to keep ourselves from getting sick? How much of this are we doing to keep from passing the disease unknowingly, probably, to other people who might be vulnerable?
I think that's a really good question, because we do know that a certain proportion of people, whether you're young or old, may acquire the infection but be asymptomatic and be able to spread that infection to others. And that's been a huge reason why safer at home orders were necessary, is that we were seeing community spread and not really knowing where the cases were transmitting, you know, from. And so nothing about the virus in that way has changed. And so the behaviors that we engage in, they don't just protect us, but they do sort of protect other people. So we kind of want to still be under the assumption that I don't know that I wasn't exposed, you know, last week when I went and got my hair cut. So I want to be careful still to not be out in the community and potentially exposing others while I don't realize that I, you know, have become ill.
Now, we've mentioned masks a couple times. What is the rule of thumb for when we probably want to have a mask on?
Well, I'd say anytime that you're out in public or socializing and it's difficult to maintain a 6-foot social distance, that's definitely a time where you should wear one. And then, you know, even in as we start to open up our interactions, I don't think it's bad practice to wear a cloth mask. And, you know, even if you're outside and sort of trying to maintain social distancing, I think it would behoove us to sort of take a cautious approach at first. Now, the thing about coronavirus and about the timeline of this infection is that it will take, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks to see what the effects have been of reopening the state and maybe your locality in particular, right? It's not immediate. And so kind of what we do this weekend and in the coming weeks will become, the effect of that will become apparent down the line. And so I'm all for taking kind of a slow approach, so we have the time, the public health experts have the time to evaluate what the consequences are of reopening.
So it sounds like a good first step is something outside, maybe a nice walk in a non-crowded area?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's already been the advice. Like, you know, if you can get out and get physical activity in an open space, that's been advocated for all during the safer at home order. So yeah, I mean, if you're going to get together with another family, for instance, or neighbors, or, you know, your sister and her children, I would try to keep everybody separate, be outside. You know, it's been recommended that you don't share food. So if you're going to have a picnic, bring all your own family's food, you know, each bring your own supplies, utensils, et cetera. You know, just to try to take a cautious approach to minimizing interactions and contacts between people as we start to venture out and get widening our social circles.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us to talk about how people can follow social distancing guidelines this holiday weekend and beyond. Coming up, we look at how Wisconsin Muslims observe the holy month of Ramadan, even as the coronavirus pandemic kept people from gathering in person. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, several listeners have asked us through WPR's Wisconsin project where the Waw part of many Wisconsin place names comes from and what it means. Think Wausau, Milwaukee, and so on. We'll talk to two native language experts for some answers. Now we look at Ramadan. It's a holiday meant to bring people together, but many Muslims in Wisconsin spent it apart this year to keep each other safe during the pandemic. Last week, Governor Evers and Lieutenant Governor Barnes hosted Wisconsin's first virtual iftar. It's a meal that Muslims eat after sunset during the holy month. It's usually done together as a community. Ramadan draws to a close this weekend. We're looking at how social distancing changed the way people spent it. Muna Algathi is an education engagement specialist at PBS Wisconsin. She observed the holy month of Ramadan. Muna, great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
And Sheikh Noman Hussein is an imam and the resident scholar of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee West. Imam Noman Hussein, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
Well, Imam Noman Hussein, Ramadan is currently winding down. Can you just tell us a little bit about what the month of Ramadan means for Muslims?
So the month of Ramadan is probably the most blessed and important month for the Muslim community. It is a month where we come together. We're fasting from the break of dawn until sunset. Every evening, we're gathering in the mosques to recite the entire Quran in our prayers. It's a time of a lot of happiness and celebration, coming together, of breaking meal together and breaking our fast together. And so it really is the pinnacle of, you know, the year for all of us, where we're looking forward to this amazing opportunity of rejuvenating, reconnecting, and coming together as a community. This is a month where we give in charity abundantly. This is a month where we're told to remember those. And one of the spirits of fasting is really to think about all the blessings that we're given, and also to remember those who may not have the blessings that we were given and may be less fortunate. And so that is really the essence of the month of Ramadan, finding a way of becoming more God-conscious and connecting to our Creator.
You mentioned the word together and community a few times there, and that was hard this time around with social distancing and trying to avoid spreading this pandemic. How did that change things for Ramadan in 2020?
You know, the past 2 months have been challenging overall for our community. Every Friday is our, day of prayer. And for the community to have to, you know, now understand and realize that, well, we can't come for that Friday prayer anymore was already difficult. I think the month of Ramadan became a distraction from the pandemic somewhat, although we definitely felt, disconnected from our overall community. We've been doing our programming through, you know, Zoom and Facebook Live and YouTube Live and all of these other platforms, which actually has kept us connected. And surprisingly, it seems that we've had more engagement online than we probably would if we did a lot of these programs in person. And so, yes, it is a unique circumstance that we're all in, but we're all trying to find a way of making the most of it. I've been telling my own congregation here in the Milwaukee area that, look, this is time where we figure out how we can make our homes a spiritual hub, that God is not just in our mosque, but God is with us at all times, and we can worship Him at our home, and we can worship Him as a family and grow together spiritually as well.
And Muna, how did the pandemic change the way you personally observed Ramadan this year?
Yeah, going off of what Imam Noam, it's usually a time where me and my family are going to the mosque every night. We're spending the night in prayer, and we're seeing people that we might not see for the rest of the year, but we're spending time, whether it's breaking fast together or praying or reading Quran. And so not being able to do that was something I was really worried about when Safer at Home started. And for myself, that was in March 16th. I was thinking that, well, Ramadan's still a while away. Maybe we'll be able to still congregate. And so it was kind of like I wasn't even realizing how different Ramadan was going to be this year. But I agree with what Imam Noman was saying, that it's really been special getting to kind of cultivate that spirituality in my own home, which was something that I usually sought out from the mosques.
That said, Muna, was there something that you particularly missed this year, given the inability to gather in person?
Absolutely. Usually my friends and I will meet up at least weekly and we'll have some sort of discussion topic and we'll just go around and share, regarding a certain topic, and then we'll bring different meals and share that together. And not being able to do that has been particularly difficult, but we found ways to stay connected.
And Imam Noman Hussein, last week you were a guest speaker at that virtual iftar we mentioned last week with the governor and lieutenant governor. What was it like to share, again, this virtual experience with members of the Wisconsin community, Muslims and non-Muslims alike in that case?
You know, we've been trying to find that silver lining in any way possible in everything that we're doing. I'm actually extremely grateful to the governor and lieutenant governor for hosting the iftar. It's been a while since we've had one, but to come together even virtually with over 200 families from all over Wisconsin joining us was just beautiful. Being able to hear the governor, lieutenant governor, and some of the Muslim leaders, and then very beautifully ending off our session with praying to God. And then breaking our fast, I thought was extremely amazing and powerful and unique. That shows us the beauty in our communities and the diversity in our society.
Muna, Eid is this weekend. It's a holiday that happens at the end of the fasting of Ramadan, as I understand it. How are you going to be celebrating that? Again, an event that's usually done with the community.
Yeah, so the way that Madison is going to be celebrating Eid is there's going to be kind of an Eid drive-through parade, and what families are invited to do is decorate their cars and drive past the masjid, one of the ones that we have on Hammersley Road, and children will be given gifts by volunteers from a distance. And personally, I am so grateful that my family live here in Madison, so we've been quarantining together, and we're a large family. There's seven of us, so it's nice to have our own mini community, just us. And we'll probably be dressing up really nice and, you know, making a really nice brunch and enjoying outside if we can.
And Sheikh Noman Hussein, has this experience shaped, maybe changed the way you and your congregation thinks about the concept of community?
Oh, for sure. Definitely. We all realize that, especially during this month of Ramadan, that a lot of the distractions that we had or a lot of things that we thought that brought us together are not necessary to bring us together. Like sometimes, yes, meeting in person is amazing, but we know that when our hearts are united, that connection remains even though we don't see each other. And when we have the opportunity to meet each other again, the times that we come together and the opportunity that we have to meet each other once again will be a very unique and very special experience. For all of us, the love that has been created and the bonds that will continue to last from this is actually something very, very powerful. And I think that something that we all will learn as a community, the way that we worship, the way that we have our services, the way that we communicate with our family, the way that we've done, even our lectures and our meetings and our services, everything's become more efficient. Everything's become more streamlined because of this pandemic that we've been experiencing.
I want to end on a lighter note. Every Friday we talk about food some here on the show, and I understand that Eid is all about or a lot about the food that is served. I wanted to ask each of you a favorite dish that you look forward to on Eid. Amuna, let's start with you.
Yeah, so one of the dishes that I look most forward to is baklava, and my sister is phenomenal at making baklava from scratch. And yeah, I'm really excited to be sharing that with my family.
And Imam Noman Hussein, is there a particular food you look forward to?
Yeah, so I'm going to stick with the sweets as well, because Eid is a day of really just having a lot of sweets. And so we have a dish called the shirhuma, which is basically a milk-based, almost a sweet milk type of drink, really nicely warm and served hot. So, I mean, that's like the staple Eid sweet for a lot of us. And so I'm really looking forward to that.
That sounds fantastic. Imam Noman Hussein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
And Muna, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Sheikh Noman Hussein is an imam and resident scholar of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee West. And Muna Algaithi is an education engagement specialist at PBS Wisconsin. She observed the holy month of Ramadan. Also, they've been joining us to talk about how the religious month of Ramadan has looked a little differently during the coronavirus pandemic, social distancing, and how a lot of the in-person community things that people look forward to this kind of year have been replaced in different ways with ways of meeting online. If you also have been observing Ramadan, love to hear from you and maybe a unique story that you can share. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Son of Pac-Man in action, and today is his 40th birthday. He doesn't look a day over 37. On this day in 1980, a Pac-Man video game machine was released to the public for the first time in Tokyo. The hungry circle dude munched on dots and fruits while being chased around by the ghosts Blinky, Pinky, Inky, and Clyde. Toru Iwatani, the game's creator, wanted to make something different from the shooting video games on the market, things like Space Invaders. He was inspired by a pizza with a slice taken out of it, and so the character of Pac-Man was born. The Pac in the name comes from Paku Paku, the Japanese sound-like phrase apparently for eating, kind of like I might say om nom nom. That inspired the eating sound in the game, too. The original name, though, was Puck-Man. But especially for American release, there were concerns about graffiti artists changing the name in an unfortunate direction. Pac-Man didn't get a huge response in its initial tryout, but it quickly became a video game sensation. It packed arcades. They couldn't get enough machines in for a while. It inspired songs, a macaroni and cheese variety, and a TV cartoon. The spinoff, Ms. Pac-Man, was originally a knockoff created by MIT students. They hacked into the game to create new looks and levels. Then they sold their design to the video game company Midway. Happy birthday, Pac-Man, from Central Time.